Well, welcome here. Thank you for coming to this class on preparation. You have a handout, and as you listen, you should be able to fill in the blanks relatively easily. The goal, the purpose of this particular session is to identify some key areas of teacher preparedness. And we want to focus specifically on preparing efficient and effective classes. Eventually, we'll get to that part. If you have taken the CLE teacher training, the CLE facilitated teacher training, this is really a summary of the one light unit that you work through titled Preparing to Teach. From this book, The First Days of School, we begin with a quote. The three most important words for a teacher are preparation, and let's say it together, preparation. That's right. Not so long ago, Mr. Conrad here in the front row took me for a ride in an airplane, and I was intrigued and comforted by his preparations. He looked over that airplane as if my and his life depended on it, and indeed they did. No surprises in the sky that day that related to things that he could have been prepared for. Same with the teacher. I am sure that there are some in this room that could actually conduct a better class than I could on preparation, but I better be sure that I'm the one most prepared to conduct the class. Am I making sense? Yeah. And so that gives me what little edge of advantage I have over others in this room, and that I prepared for it. When I was a young teacher, my teacher from when I was in school sat where you're sitting in a workshop that I was conducting at a teacher's meeting. And of course, I was rather nervous about that. And I told him afterwards, I said, "Brother Ronnie, it just seemed like you and I should have traded places." And he said, "Oh no." He said, "I wouldn't have been nearly as prepared as you." And there's the difference. Your success as a teacher is going to rise and fall in this key area. There may be other key areas as well, but this is a key area on which our success depends, being prepared. We're going to begin, first of all, by talking about preparing in prayer. Preparing in prayer. Not so long ago, I was reading through Psalm 51. That's the one that begins, "Have mercy upon me, O God. Blot out my transgressions. I acknowledge I've sinned," and so on. You know the psalm. And it keeps on going. David keeps on speaking there. The psalmist, I think it's David, keeps on talking about how he wants to be in fellowship and right fellowship with the Lord God Almighty. And when he finally reaches a certain point in that psalm, about verse 13, all of a sudden he just sort of bursts forth. "Then will I teach. Then will I teach." There is a connectedness with proper spiritual position and the ability to teach. And if you question that, read the psalm, Psalm 51. In this book by Bruce Wilkinson, he says that teachers impact more by their character and commitment than by their communication. Oh, really? Do you believe that? That teachers impact more by their character commitment than by their communication? I don't know about you, but if that's true, that scares me. So here we are trying to learn how to prepare to have effective and efficient classes and be good communicators. And that certainly is appropriate. But my character and my commitment is going to impact students more. We dare not lead on empty spiritually. We're not going to get any further than our vehicle goes when it's running on fumes. So, as a teacher now, you probably will be developing some new word constructions in your prayers. And I just decided to get real honest and open with you. I'll give you some word constructions in my prayers. And you will notice that I don't speak to God in a very polished way. One of the things that I prayed pretty often is, "God, give me what it takes. Give me what it takes. And that was so almost more a desperation than anything. You see, do I have enough of Christ in me to do this work is a question that that prayer was born out of. God, give me what it takes. Here's another one. God, help me to be patient today. Every teacher, each individual in this room has their own strengths and weaknesses. Patience is not my strength. When I get against something hard, I don't sit back and relax. I tend to, you know, shoot gravel out the back and, you know, put a little more effort into this thing. And I have found that when in my former occupation, when I was pulling wires around such a room as this with holes in the studs, if you jerk on the wires a little bit harder, it works out. I found out that it doesn't work that way in the classroom. You can't just jerk a little bit harder. You can't make an ugly face and go, "Oof," and then it'll come. It doesn't work that way. So I have learned to really, really appreciate a duck that swims in the pond. You've seen them. They can really make progress, ripple water out around their chest. It looks peaceful. It looks serene. They're cruising along. But did you ever see a duck from the bottom side looking up at the feet? That's the way we teachers need to be. We need to have all that motion and all that energy contained in our head and keep calm, cool, and collected as we meet our challenges. But we get all that frustration when we get that whole model upside down, you know, and I'll get all that out for everybody else to see. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. So we're talking about preparing to teach. Another prayer of preparation I prayed for often was a sound mind and a healthy body. I hate to teach school when I'm sick. Another one that I prayed fairly frequently is, "God, I'm sorry, I can't do this." And I most often prayed that prayer about 8 o'clock and school was starting at 8:30. And I have found that when I prayed that prayer and really meant it, God wasn't very sorry at all. And it seemed that we had better days that day. Another one I prayed is the serenity prayer. "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change." You know it well. "Courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." That's something that we're trying to sort out all the time we're teaching. Is this something that I can really, can I get more performance out of this young chap, or can I not? Can I change this, or can't I? And finding that balance is indeed where serenity is found. Here's another serenity prayer, modified slightly. "God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know that that's me." All right, finish the verse for me. "If any of you lack wisdom, let him," what of God? "Ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be" what?
Yes.
Praise God for that. Praise God. "Not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think anything as of ourselves, but our sufficiency is of God." The best preparation you can have to teach is to get you and God at peace, and to get that peace incorporated into your relationships with other people, and love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, and mind. That is done best through the very thing we're talking about, prayer. Moving on now to the second point. This is preparing expectations. I'm going to read to you a portion from this book, Preparing and Expectations. What do you expect from school? What do you expect from your students? I'm simply going to read this and let the story do the teaching. I, Bruce Wilkinson, stood like a rock in a rushing stream of preoccupied Bible college students. It was fall registration, organized chaos. I'd seen it all before many times, but this time, instead of racing around the gymnasium signing up for classes, I watched as students signed up for my classes. It was my first year out of graduate school, and I was just hours away from my debut on the other side of the lectern. Taking a closer look at several of the registration tables, I noticed that I had been assigned sections 1, 2, and 3 of the course called Bible Study Methods. The remaining 5 sections were taught by others. After walking around for 20 minutes, I left the gym and headed across the campus toward my office. A well-seasoned faculty member at the college caught up with me and said, "I just can't believe it." "You can't believe what?" "They gave you section 2, didn't they?" Well, yes, I guess they did. He shook his head in seeming unbelief. I just can't believe it. You're the new faculty member, the first year rookie, and they gave you Section 2. He had me perplexed. Why? What's so special about Section 2? You mean they didn't tell you that at faculty orientation? The truth was, I was the only new faculty member that year, so they didn't have a faculty orientation. So I asked him to explain it to me. Well, Section 2 has all the top high school seniors coming into the freshman class, the honors group, cream of the crop, the most outstanding group of students in the whole college. We stopped outside the faculty offices, and he leveled his gaze at me. Bruce, you're not going to believe the difference teaching Section 2. What do you mean, I asked, not knowing whether to feel exhilarated or intimidated. Growing up, I had never been Section 2, I didn't think. Motivation, like a team of wild horses straining at the reins. Those kids will just pull it out of you. You're going to love every minute of it. Wow, first-year teacher, I can't believe the luck. He walked down the sidewalk, shaking his head, and I was intrigued, too, to say the least. The next day, Section 1 filed in, and we had a good hour. Nothing outstanding, just a good give-and-take session with a solid group of young men and women. After the break, Section 2 walked in. And I couldn't believe it. He was absolutely right. I could just feel the electricity in the air. From the ring of the bell, the class just flew by as the teacher and students learned at almost warp speed. It was like stepping on a surfboard and riding the crest of the wave the entire hour. At times, the class interest and desire to learn swept over me with such intensity, I had trouble staying on top of it. Everything seemed different. Their questions, eye contact, facial expressions, even the way they sat in their chairs. It was incredible. My colleague was absolutely right. These students pulled the best out of you. Section 3 came in later that day, and I realized in a mere few seconds that they were just like Section 1. Good, yes, but nowhere near the caliber of Section 2. As the semester progressed, I found myself increasingly grateful to God for leading me into the ministry of teaching. I'd never felt so challenged and fulfilled, and though I enjoyed all my classes, Section 2 always made my day. As we neared midterms, I found myself walking to a faculty meeting with the academic dean, Dr. Joseph Wong. Well, Bruce, he said, you're at the halfway point now of your first year. The honeymoon's over. How do you enjoy teaching college? It's absolutely terrific. Better than I'd imagined. He smiled. That's great to hear. What's your favorite part of teaching? Without thinking, I blurted it out. Section 2! He raised his eyebrows and even stopped walking in order to listen more intently, I thought. You have Section 2? Tell me about that. It was the first chance I had to express my delight, my gratitude for the opportunity to teach 30 of the keenest students I had ever encountered. I must have sung their praises for a couple of minutes as I described the amazing difference between them and the rest of my class. The dean looked thoughtful as I went on and on about this gifted group of young men and women. When I had finished, he said, glad you're having so much success, Bruce, but I need to tell you something that may surprise you a bit. There's no honors class this year. We canceled it. My mouth went dry. Joe, you got to be kidding me. No, I'm not kidding. Last year, we decided it would be better if we spread the top students through all the classes. We thought it would add a little more spark to each of the sections. Dizzy with disbelief, I said, Joe, I'll catch you in a few minutes. I need to go back to my office. I raced to my office and dialed the registrar, sure that my colleague was trying to pull something over this rookie. Joyce, I said, I've got Section 2, Bible study methods, right? That's right, Bruce. I swallowed hard. And Joyce, that section, Section 2, contains all the outstanding students, the top freshmen, right? Well, no, Bruce. We canceled that program last year. Groaning inwardly, I thanked her and hung up the phone. I couldn't seem to come to grips with what was happening here. With reluctance, I reached for my grade book and opened it. I compared the grades, Sections 1 and 3, with Sections 2. The difference was staggering. I pulled a stack of ungraded papers off my bookshelf. Stacking Section 1 and 3 on top of each other, I compared that pile with the stack from Section 2 by itself. Section 2 had more pages than the other two sections combined. What remarkable diligence! I went through the papers one by one, page by page, and the difference was dramatic. The Section 2 students outshone their peers again and again.
That day proved to be one of the most dramatic learning experiences of my life, and I've never still quite gotten over it. For the first time, I realized that what I believed about my students made an incredible difference in what they learned in my class. You see, there was no real difference between sections 1, 2, and 3. It was the same content, same day of the week, same pool of 18 and 19-year-old students. Not one difference. In fact, never once did I say, "You're section 2 and your performance should reflect it." Then how could I explain such a dramatic difference in what these students learn? The only difference was expectations. All right, moving to point 3, know your students. This is something that is hard to do while you're sitting here in this room or when you're here at Teacher's Instruction Course. But if your school has been opened as run in previous years, you can pull the student file, and there's a remarkable amount of information you can get right out of the student file. If your school gives achievement tests, you can see it's very low-hanging fruit. You can easily see what is that student's challenge, what is their strength. I taught for 8 years at the last school where I taught, and when I moved to that school, I made a scrapbook for myself where I got an extra annual, school newspaper, whatever you call it, and I cut out the picture, pasted it on the top, put their name on the top of the paper so I could get all the Rusevukes and the Trebkos and the Golubenkos straightened out. And then underneath there I put, you know, how many years they had been at that school, what their strength was in academically, what their weakness was academically, if they had any siblings at school. Just build a profile, if you would, for each student. And that helped tremendously in my preparations. If you're moving into a new community, you might want to spend half a morning. We'll get you on the map with this point. But then when you're working with the students, it's always nice when school has gone, has progressed about 6 weeks, because then you take a lot of the guesswork out. You know, you actually know the students a good bit better, but you begin to learn their interests, their predilections. You can develop your relationship with them. But in fact, that is something you can do this week if you want to. You can work at developing the relationship with them. You can send them a postcard now. Seems to me I had a postcard somewhere along the way here, but I forgot to prepare for that. But I had a postcard I could wave in the air and show you. You can go to dollar stores and get postcards and just say, "Hi, Billy. I'm in Oregon right now learning how to have a good year with you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in about 3 weeks, teacher." And it will do something for you. I'm sure that it will do something for your relationship. That's the kind of thing that can be done now. But do enjoy the blessings of working among children. I think Tracy Kidder wrote a book titled just that, Among Children. Maybe you've read that book, but it probably is a part of teaching that I miss the most, learning to know young people. All right, know your school. Two things about school in a general sense that you should try to ascertain. The one is your school culture. Every school has a culture. What they do and how they do it is what I mean by culture. The games they play, the times of assembly, or for devotions, for choir practice, procedures for assembly time, recess times, how much recess do they get, how do they regard homework, how do the parents regard homework. All these things make up a school culture. Right now, my involvement with school has some to do with going around and visiting various schools as a COE rep and just walk around and say, "Hi, how have you been? I'm Jonathan." And then we talk about school. Not necessarily only COE things, about anything that teachers want to talk about. One school I was visiting after school, the teachers, all their hair, get me correct here, was kind of like, "How in the world does COE expect the students to get done with all this work? Does CLE seriously, I mean, really now, come on, down to the brass tacks here, do they really think that students can get this much work done?" And I sort of backed up and hunkered down in the corner, smoothed my hair down, and said, "Yeah." And then we talked about it. Later on that day, I went to another school, and it had a whole other set of culture, right? How do you know? Well, I said it was another school. Right, they had. It was strange because not many schools do I get to that have such identical sets of curriculum. Okay, this school, the second school, had almost 100% identical to the other. And they were a very happy school. Things were just chugging along there wondrously. And I asked, I said, how is it with getting done with the work? Well, we get done with the work. There's no problem here with that. Do students have a lot of homework? No. No, they don't have a lot of homework. Right? What was the difference? Culture. Right? The school culture. And you're, at this point, you probably don't know your school culture as well as you will in 6 weeks from now. Of course, if you're teaching at home, that's one thing. Maybe you're teaching at a school where you actually attended as a student. But school culture is something that needs to be learned. School structure is another thing I would mention. This makes a difference. How your school is structured. You need to know, do you have a principal or do you have a chairman that is also the principal? Is your school church-sponsored or is it patron-sponsored? See, if it's church-sponsored, that has its own set of culture. And I'm suspicious or suspecting that many of the schools here are church-sponsored. But don't take that for granted. Don't take my word for it. You may be actually going to a community that has a patron-run school. Or conversely, if you grew up in a patron-sponsored school and you're going to a church-sponsored school, there is a difference. And we don't have all the time to discuss that at length. But if you're teaching at a patron, I taught at both. If you're teaching at a patron-run school, the patrons are going to be acting just a little bit different than they will in a church-run school. And so will the ministry be acting a little bit different. Okay? These are things that we need to understand about the particular setting. We call it a setting. When I hear that word used in this context, I think of a table. You know, you ladies can do this, I can't. But you can get a tablecloth, you can do a setting, right? And you can... Well, I don't need to describe this to you. Look at that pile of pallets down there and you have a setting, right? Your school has a setting too. Okay, learn the school setting. All right, next is know your curriculum. What I'm really trying to do here, let's just step back a little bit. What I'm really trying to do is when you walk into an empty classroom here in just a few weeks, you're going to have to get all this put together. There's classroom decor. There's all sorts of preparations you need to do. But this thing of a school curriculum is a big one. I really think that it ought to be your first thing on the list that you do. Personally, I think you ought to get a table and lay out your school curriculum. The way that I typically did it is I would write on the board each grade that I was responsible for, the student's name, put a big number up there. Okay, I got 3 in first grade, I got 4 in second, or whatever. You know, I wasn't teaching those grades, but you get the idea. And then I put corresponding piles to those students. And the reason you need to do this first is because the individual who ordered the curriculum might not have gotten it all right. In fact, that's why CLE actually has to hire in more help just before school starts, because the curriculum order, poof, here comes this glut of curriculum orders that people want right now because they want to start school. Okay, get ahead of the wave, get your curriculum laid out in piles. And just that motion of going through laying out your curriculum does get you familiar with it, just the handling of it. And after a while, you can stand back and say, okay, so in 7th grade math, it's these blue books right here, it's these green books, and it's this reader with that workbook, and yes, here's all the tests, and so on. Get all that stuff figured out first off. Then worry about putting up your ladybugs and lighthouses. Okay? Not the other way around. Right? Now, this yet about knowing your curriculum. Let's make an analogy here to a shoe. We have different types of footwear here, and I see that if you were going to be given the raw material to make a shoe, one of the first things you have to decide is it going to be a slip-on or a tie shoe? Right? And after that, you're going to have to decide, you know, how many laces, lace holes. You're going to have to decide, is this going to be a running shoe, a walking shoe, or a sitting shoe, or whatever. I mean, there's so many different kinds of shoes out there. Do you know what? It's the same way in curriculum, too. It really is. If you're going to design a curriculum, it's going to follow a model. There's somehow that knowledge is going to be packaged and presented to the student. And most curriculums are going to divide into two, the one being a unit or chapter based
curriculum. And the other is going to be what I'm going to call spiral. And there's other terms for this. But when you have a unit or chapter-based curriculum, it's kind of like if this is the level of understanding we want a student to have at the end of the chapter on adjectives in seventh grade, and here's where we're starting. We're going to start out with the first lesson, and it's going to talk about what is an adjective. And the next lesson is going to be, maybe placing those things on diagrams, and I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but each lesson is going to continue to go a little bit further, until the last lesson we're diagramming adjective clauses. It's the hardest lesson in the book about adjectives. The following lesson will be a review, and then we have a test. Right? That works. Many curriculums are designed like that. Right? The review here is incidental. You might be studying the previous chapter where it might have been nouns, but they've already tested on the nouns. And that's history. And so you can almost skip the review, and you didn't affect the learning experience here about adjectives. Right? The spiral curriculum is not a ramp, and I can't draw a spiral ramp. Let me try. Yeah. Will that work? Think park class, yes. Think parking garage at the mall or at the airport, right? And so with the spiral curriculum, what we're doing there is the first time we hit adjectives for that grade level, we're just going to have an introduction. It's nothing about mastery. It's just more introduction. The next lesson takes it a little bit further, and the review becomes ultimately very, very important. Whereas here we can strip the review out and still pass the test on adjectives. There's no way to strip the review out of the spiral curriculum because CLE is a review curriculum. Rod and Stab is a chapter or unit-based curriculum. If you strip the review out of the spiral curriculum, you've actually stripped out one of the main ways that you learn. CLE says that we have 30% new material and 70% review in a daily lesson. Rod and Staff is not 70-30. It's more of the... I'm just guessing. Okay? The first year that I taught school, English language was my weakness. I had to study terrifically hard just to stay ahead of the students, and I stayed one day ahead of the students that whole year. Next year was about 2 days ahead, and so on. I did not assign any of the review simply because I was too shot. I was too tired. And because I wasn't prepared, this is a rookie confessing here. But it was okay. The students passed their tests and so on. You can't do that with a spiral-based curriculum. So just examining your curriculum and understanding how it's constructed will help you know how to relate to it. Right, let's move on. Maybe I should say this yet. The catchphrase with the spiral curriculum is incremental learning with continuous review. Right, know your schedule. I have two blanks there. The one is personal life, the other is school life. And I'm not going to comment much about this, but one of the things that school teaching will do for you if you respond to the opportunity correctly is it will make you a very efficient, can you process that? Yeah. It will make your life very efficient because of all these externals that are coming in on you. I mean, school starts every morning at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, whatever the case may be. And then you have to be prepared for that to move along and get done with the day when the last bell rings. So in both your personal life and your school life, create a time budget. Be careful about the snooze in your personal life. So many things go wrong simply because we didn't do the right thing at the right time. But what would you think if Edwin here, let's suppose he's aspiring to be a carpenter, and he just doesn't show up on the job with his tool belt. He left it in the car from yesterday, and he forgot this morning he rode his bike to meet the van. What's going to happen? His day's wrecked. Right? So we need to think ahead. We need to plan a schedule for our personal life. Do the right thing at the right time. School life. Get last year's schedule if you're
a first-year teacher. Get last year's schedule. Most teachers really need to carefully budget their time. Otherwise, you're not going to get across the classes that they need to conduct. And they won't conduct the classes with enough conciseness, enough clarity, that they can get across everything they need to in a day. Prepare your records. We have a number of records listed out here. The first is a teacher's planner. That's a book or a spreadsheet or a something where you know what you're going to do for that day and for that week. I think it's very good for first-year teachers to be planning the week out and then do the week and then plan the next week out and then do that week. I think it's very good for first-year teachers to plan on whatever your personal schedule dictates. If it works best for you to plan Friday afternoon, plan the next week. That's great. For myself, for the first few years that I taught school, I would not allow myself to do any Saturday-type activities other than sleeping in until I had my weekly schedule planned for the following week. Okay? Just part of your duties and part of preparing. Perhaps as you teach longer and as you know the lessons and as you open up the book and can remember teaching this 10 times before, that may be another story. It is, in fact, another story. But you need to have a planner. You also need to have a grade book of some sort where you record grades. And by the way, that goes back to school culture. Does your school expect you to record daily grades? Do they expect you to record only tests and quizzes? That's part of school culture. And don't go in there trying to change it yet. Just go with the flow. Make it happen according to the way it's been happening for a while. You need to teach there for at least 3 or 4 years anyway before you can make a serious impact on the school's culture. That's about the way it works. But one caution about grade books and plan books, and I am from the old school. That's just where God placed me. But I have a rising concern about how much time a rookie teacher spends stroking a computer. Computers can really take a lot of time, and I'm really not sure that, well, let me back up. I'm really sure that you don't need a computer to teach school. More years in the history of the world have been school teachers that went without computers than with. Just keep that in mind. I'm not against using a computer, not at all. But there can be a terrific amount of time spent on getting the right grade book and hee-hawing around with this and goofing with that and getting it to print properly. And one of my fellow teachers was using a computer-based planner and gradebook system, and he got things so messed up that I reinvented that quote about to errors but human to forgive is divine. Now it reads to errors but human, but to takes computer to really mess things up. Be careful with this, right? Warren Buffett said it so right. He said, "Games were never won by watching the scoreboard." I think somebody had asked him how often he checks the stock market index. And he said, not very often. So games aren't won by watching the scoreboard. Now that's something to think about. I think that we ought to be spending more time in preparation for effective classes than we ought to be spending, or than we spend in all this electronic distraction. Another thing you ought to find out about that goes along with school records, preparing your records. This is maybe off to the side just a little bit, but does your school have a handbook? If your school existed for a number of years, it likely has a handbook of sorts. It might just be a list of just a list on a single sheet of paper, where the secretary, one school where I taught, the secretary was required that any time the board made a policy, he had to write that down. Is that a paper that you ought to have before you enter the classroom? A paper that has all the policies that the board enacted over the years? Well, it would seem like it. Yeah, you ought to have that. Right? Maybe your school went a little bit further and has a handbook. You ought to have that. A curriculum guide. Not every school will have a curriculum guide, but again, if your school has a curriculum guide, you'll want this too, which basically says, this is what fifth grade does for math at this school, and this is what fifth grade does for social studies. And the even-numbered years, they have this book with sixth grade, and the odd-numbered years, and so on. Right? That's something that if your school has, you really need to get a copy of that curriculum guide. It can be very helpful. And if your school doesn't have one, I would recommend that near the end of the year that you start a tradition of making a curriculum guide. It takes by the time you get to the end of the year, it takes 15 minutes. You can write down what you did that year, curriculum-wise.
and there it is for the people coming behind you. I want to smooth out the road, we sing sometimes, and make it easier for those behind. Well, here's a wonderful way to do it. Write down what's happening at your school. Every student should have a permanent file record. I think we're on point E now. The student permanent file. And in that permanent file, it should be a copy of their report card, a copy of their achievement tests, that type of thing. Maybe F could be part of this permanent file, admission forms. In other words, here's a document that says, yes, Senior Herb wants Junior Herb to be enrolled in this school. And basically parental consent. This became very important to me one day when a sixth grade girl, not my student actually, but after dismissal, I heard some horrendous yelling and some great excitement among the students that were still there. And this sixth grade girl had somehow, to this day I don't know how she did it, but she cut the calf of her leg open so far that I could have laid my hand in it. And, well, we're to shorten the story, I scooped her up, and on my way out to the car, I hollered over my shoulder, "Get Christina's file!" And when I walked into the emergency room in a big city hospital carrying a girl with in that condition, it was mighty comforting to be able to have those papers to set up on the counter beside that girl and say, "Hi, I'm right here. I'm Jonathan Herb. I'm the teacher of Christina Chogan, and she had an accident here at school. Her parents are on the way, but right now, you know, I brought her in." Today's culture, not school culture, but out there in the big wide world, very important papers to have on file and readily accessible. Medical records might be part of this as well, where if a student has allergies and so on, it's given to seizures, has special diet restrictions and so on. It's good to know. And the last one, of course, is achievement tests, which I mentioned before. All right, we're moving on. Preparing. Now we actually get to preparing the classroom and other areas, desks, decor, and so on. I think we're going to move to prepare to teach at this point. Law 1 of John Milton Gregory's book, The Seven Laws of Teaching, Law 1 says that the teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. And there is, this afternoon, I'm supposed to give one of those six-minute talks about preparing for lessons, so you're going to hear some repeat there, probably. So now we have all the books laid out. We have them all coinciding with the student names. What do we do next when it comes to the textbook? Well, open that textbook, read the part inside it that says "to the teacher." Right? Now, that can really be amazing what you might find there. Look how many lessons are in the book. Try to figure out how many times you're going to have this a year to complete the course. Does the curriculum guide say you're even supposed to complete the course? I went into a major panic one year when I was teaching Rod and Staff math when halfway through the year, my teacher's guide ran out. I mean, we were only halfway through the year and it was done. And I needed a teacher's guide, you know, like right now. And I didn't realize there were two teacher's guides. Right? Actually, it wasn't me. It was another school rep was visiting at a school where they were using the CLE Learning to Read curriculum. And that curriculum actually has multiple parts. It has, you know, you do this and you do this and you get that from here and you do this here and you do that then. And this first grade teacher was registering a bit of a complaint, which is what, you know, teachers are supposed to do when they like to see changes with the curriculum. She was saying that she just wishes that there just really should be, or could be actually, a table where it says what you're supposed to do every day. And I guess this is one of the reasons that CLE has reps on the road. That rep was able to open up the teacher's guide, which she carried along with her every single day, and say, "Here." Right? You feel a little bit silly. And I kind of pity that teacher. But yet, if you're learning from her mistake, it was worth it, right? Familiarize yourself with the teacher material. There's just a tremendous amount of good in there that you might not have to reinvent the wheel. That's what she was doing. She was creating a plan to you know, when do we bring in the language arts and all this sort of jazz? Well, all that jazz was figured out for her, if she only would have had her eyes opened at the right place. So get that course overview. Look through the table of contents. Get to know the book. Now, talking about daily lesson preparation,
For every lesson, there's objectives. Now, I'm sorry to tell you that I missed this for years. I taught school not realizing that for every lesson, there's objectives. Objectives simply mean takeaways or the main point. I know that I'm kind of silly and stupid, but I read this book just in time, and that's one of the points he makes. He doesn't call them takeaways. He doesn't call them objectives. He calls them minimums for mastery. Same concept, different package. Right? He says all you need to do as a teacher is identify what are the minimums for mastery on that particular lesson. And then what you do is you teach those minimums for mastery. You explain those minimums for mastery. If it's a skill-based lesson, you show them how to do the skill of multiplying by fractions. And every lesson has objectives. I can't say it loudly and strong enough. When you're preparing for a lesson, you should open up your book and then get to the point where you can hold still and identify. Oh, I see. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. Seriously, usually, a lesson doesn't have more than 3 objectives. You know where you find the objectives? If you want to find them, spoon-fed silver platter in the teacher's guide. Okay? It's where they are. It's where you find them. Now, if you don't have a very refined course, you might have to come up with them yourself. But if you study a lesson enough to come up with objectives, you've studied the lesson enough to teach it, I think. Because you know what's in there, right? It is so, so important to identify the lesson objectives. And this applies not only to math, but also to language. And also only to language, but also to reading. You see, there's different types of school subjects. Think about reading. In the younger grades, teaching reading, of course you're going to have objectives. Ah, there's an apple. All right? And then you're going to be slicing the apples and dicing the apples and slinging apples all over the place, right? You know, follow my analogy. I speak figuratively, of course. But even in older grades, the teacher's guide is probably going to say, what is the objective here? And of course, maybe the objective is to be able to familiarize students with the fact that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But the objective of reading is to develop reading comprehension. And many reading curriculums, it will say, what specific type of comprehension is being developed in these specific exercises? It's really amazing, really handy, really nice. It's there. The point I'm trying to make is very simple. Identify the objectives. What are we learning? And then, once we've identified those objectives, we can plan the lead-in. In other words, the introduction. And usually, especially in the skills-based subject, if today you're going to be teaching how to, whatever, subtract fractions, well, a great lead-in is starting with adding fractions. Students, remember how, in the last few lessons, we've been working with adding fractions. Right now, today, after we've done some of these on the board, the only thing that changes is the plus becomes a minus. And when we do that, there's some things that are very similar to adding fractions. You see what we're doing? We're teaching the unknown in terms of the known. And that is that usually works very well in the skill-based subjects to lead in with review. And then, of course, emphasize the minimums for mastery. There I have it on your paper, number 3. And number 4 is do it all the night before. Do it all the night before. Don't wait, unless you're an extreme morning person, don't wait to do it until the morning, or if you taught school for quite a number of years, you might be able to wait to do it till the morning of. I think that you should actually prepare for classes before you check, because here's why. You were hired to be a checker. No, you weren't. You were hired to be a teacher. Now, it is true that teachers sometimes check. And teachers do a lot of checking, trust me, you know that. But we were, after all, hired to be teachers first. I think that sometimes we suffer, our lessons and our classes suffer, because we spent too much time checking when we should have been preparing to teach. You were hired to be a teacher. And if teachers are going to teach, you need to know what they're going to teach. And of course, sometimes they look at the scoreboard. They do that too sometimes, of course. But you need to develop a plan whereby checking happens incidentally and teaching happens intentionally and carefully. All right, we don't have time for the questions to consider, but remember the takeaway. The 3 most important words to a painter, a pilot, or a chef are preparation, preparation, and preparation. Same for a teacher. It's easy as 1, 2, 3. Now, folks,
you get to choose. Are you going to be proactive or are you going to be reactive? Turns out you can teach from either premise. You can. The one is a whole lot more effective, and you can keep your students with you. I find that when I teach reactively, I start going into off-road mode. It's kind of fun for the driver, right? But what about those poor students? It's not about having fun as a teacher to teach on a reactive premise, right? Get proactive and do your proper preparations. Are there any questions as far as blanks on the paper that maybe you didn't quite get filled in? 9B. Oh, daily lesson preparation. Okay. Is there any others? Yes.
9A.
Textbook course overview. Okay.
Number 2, under B, 9B, number 2.
Plan the lead in. All right, end of slash. I should have been, I was thinking about the clock. Review. Lead-in is often done by review. All right, thank you for being here. I applaud your effort in getting to these meetings. And as long as you teach, please do come to teacher instruction courses of some venue somewhere, because you need it. Otherwise, you're not going to rise higher than your own level of incompetency. Your greatest weakness will be your limiting factor. Thank you. You're excused.